Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Total Film's Last Picture Show. The elevator pitch? It's the end of the world, and you have one last night at the cinema. What four films are you programming, and why? Our guest today is a critic, broadcaster, and podcast host who quit her job as a magazine editor to become a freelance film critic in 2000. And she's been writing and talking about movies ever since, in print and on TV and radio. She's a member of the London Critics Circle film section and rose to chairperson of that, as well as president of the whole organisation. And chances are, if something happens in film, it's this woman who will be offering expert opinion on news programmes. In 2018, she launched groundbreaking feminist podcast Girls on Film, and she's a regular at film festivals and on red carpets. Our guest today is the host of Girls on Film, Anna Smith. Welcome to the podcast, Anna.
Thank you very much. It's delightful to be here.
It's lovely to talk to you. I've been on your podcast a couple of times, so it's really nice that you're on our Total Film one now. So you know the pitch. You know what this is about. This is your last day on Earth, and you're going to program this beautiful event of films. Let's start off then, shall we, with how you first got into cinema and, like, what was the first film you ever saw at the cinema on a big screen that blew your mind?
Well, the first film I remember seeing, which is probably the first one, was the 1961 version of 101 Dalmatians, the animation. Oh. So obviously I'm not that old. It wasn't as it came out. It was in the 70s that I saw it. And I actually grew up partially in America. So this was in Norfolk, Virginia. And I remember going with my mother as a special treat. And we went to Roy Rogers to get a hamburger. Wow. Believe it or not, the film star Roy Rogers had his name to a branch of burger joints. And they still exist, I think, a few of them. So it was a big treat. You get a Roy Rogers burger, and then you watch 101 Dalmatians. I remember sitting there just thinking, wow, this is the life. Then, like many people, I started to associate the cinema with treats. And of course, it's a cracking film.
Yes, it is. So did you grow up for quite a while in America? Because obviously, when I was growing up, America got all the films first and a very long time ahead of the UK. Were you sort of telling all your friends back home, yeah, I've seen that. I've seen all of these things that you're waiting for?
Sadly not. We didn't go to the cinema that much, but I actually came back to the UK for the second time when I was only seven. So it was really early days. You know, we were mostly watching Disney films. It was nothing like cool bragging rights stuff. So I came back, and then we lived in Exeter in Devon, which is when I went to see some of the films we will be discussing today. Right. So yeah, that's where the love of cinema was really formed, I'd say.
That's where your formative years were in the cinema. Okay.
Definitely. Or at least watching them at home, you know, not necessarily in the cinema, but watching films. Yeah.
Once you sort of got this bug for film and you loved watching it, what drove you? Was it that you were a bit of a completist? Were you using, you know, sort of some sort of methodology to watch films, or was it literally whatever was on the telly?
I feel like you've been talking to a lot of men on this podcast. I don't wish to generalize, but I personally, I don't approach film in the way that some of our esteemed colleagues do. I'm not a collector. I'm not methodical. I actually really love films because they tell the story of humanity and they explore humanity. And I also love analysing things. I did an English degree, and I love picking things apart, figuring out how they work thematically. So that's kind of my approach. So it would be very much, I suppose, when I was younger, like anyone, what your friends was talking about, what they were going to see. But then as you got older, and I did courses in gender and popular culture at university, I'd be looking for very specific kinds of films, which sometimes my tutors would point me towards.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. No, we do have, and I'm sure you'll know some of our colleagues at Total Film who literally went through a book that was like the 1,000 greatest films you should have seen and ticked them off. There is that method of doing it, but obviously you went in a more sort of what moved you way, an emotional perhaps response.
I did. And I think obviously when I started getting into the business, because I went into this through journalism and I was editing magazines for a long time before I was specializing in film. So when I started reviewing film, it was simply what was coming out this week. I mean, one of the first films I reviewed was The Matrix when I was at a women's magazine. So obviously then I started building up my film knowledge really from the 90s onwards. So that's probably my strongest area, because I was reviewing films most weeks from the late 90s, really.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start then with your program that you're about to put on. And let's start with the first film. What are you getting in the projection booth for the beginning of this? What's it going to be?
I'm going to go for one of the most formative films for me, which I saw when I believe I was 15, and that is Back to the Future.
Hey, Doc, are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
The way I see it, if you're gonna build a time machine into a car, why not do it with some style?
Hey, McFly!
This is a big one, the one I've been waiting for all my life.
You're my mom. You're my mom.
Marty, we're sending you back to the future.
It was Christmas Day, and I think it was on the TV, and I was sitting on my bed on a tiny, tiny, tiny television in the 80s, eating Quality Street, thinking, this may just be the best experience of my entire life so far, tragically. Because, you know, I was just so in love with the magic of cinema at that moment, even though it was, you know, tiny size of postage stamp sort of screen. Not quite that tiny, but I just thought the combination of movie magic and comedy and action and absolutely spiriting you off to another world was incredible. I'd already got very into books, children's books when I was younger, that played with the idea of time and time travel. So to see that in such an accessible and such a professional and slick film was amazing. You know, having been previously reared on Disney films, to me, then to see something like this, you know, kind of, it was literally magic on the screen, and I loved it.
Did you watch it numerous times then? Were you one of those sort of obsessives that once you've seen a film and you love it, you watch it more than once?
Oh, that is one that I must have seen hundreds of times. It's one of those things that, you know, when you get insomnia, I've actually had times when I think, okay, if I go through Back to the Future scene by scene, maybe this will help send me to sleep, you know, working out which scene it is. Now I am sounding quite geeky, having said I'm not. But this is the one film I'm quite geeky about.
Yeah. And what's your favourite scene in it? Is there a particular one that stands out for you?
The beauty of it is that the no scene is wasted in this film. And I know that's an easy response, but it's the no line is wasted, no scene is wasted. But I think, you know, anything with Lorraine has got to be right up there. I think when he ends up in her parents' house and all the little Easter eggs for fans, when you know, Marty's sitting at the dinner table and they're making Barb's comments about his parents and better get used to those bars, kid, about Uncle Joey, you know, the ex-convict or the permanent convict. And also, I just think the performance, you know, Lorraine is incredible ball of sexual energy in that film and in those scenes. And I think that mixes the comedy just so beautifully with the plot progression.
Yeah. How do you feel about the sequel and the threequel? Love them as much?
I actually love Back to the Future 2 as much, if not more, which is quite controversial, I know, because I think it weaves the first film in so beautifully. It's almost like you get two for one. Yeah. So you're revisiting the first film. And as a big fan of the really darker side of sci-fi and the time twisting, I think it's more satisfying in that respect. 3 is obviously the lesser of the three, but it's still a darn good film.
Yes.
I'm not such a huge Western fan, but it's still a darn good film.
Yeah. And did you have teenage feelings for Michael J. Fox as I did watching that film?
I think I must have done. I think because all my friends fancied him at school, I was always very contrary, so I never claimed to. I would always pick the one that people didn't fancy, but I think deep down I must have done.
You were like, I love Doc Brown.
Yeah, there wasn't really an alternative, was there? So the George McFly, no.
You could have Biff or George McFly.
No. There was no one else, was there? So, yeah, I think deep down. But for me, it wasn't so much about fancying him. It was as about engaging with him as a character and actually wanting to be like him.
Yeah.
You know, because as we know, we women don't get to grow up watching many females at the centre of the story. So we have to identify with the boys. And I wanted to live that adventure.
Yeah. So let's talk about your cinema of choice. Where would you be putting this programme on and why?
I'd like to put this in an outdoor cinema, something like pop-up screens. They do them around the corner of my house, so very selfishly I might do that. But I've seen Back to the Future 4 or 5 times outdoors at these kind of summer movie screenings, and I really enjoy the atmosphere that comes from that. And rightly or wrongly, the moment when everyone cheers when George smacks Biff in the mouth, you know, going back to it, is that the right moment to be clapping? I don't know. But that is the sense of unity you get. Everyone sitting there having their beers and their burgers and their picnics and you know, strangers cheering together. I think there's more of a sense of freedom in those outdoor screenings than you might get in the cinema. So I'm going for one of those. Secret Cinema, of course, that was great fun. If I can have a little Enchantment Under the Sea dance, so much the better.
Oh, yes, indeed. Indeed. Okay, let's move on to film two, which might inform us as to sort of why you've sort of started and go towards a feminist view towards cinema that maybe you weren't looking at with Back to the Future. What is your second film?
Well, this is Thelma and Louise from 1991, Ridley Scott's feminist masterpiece.
You're getting in deeper every moment you're gone.
You want to step back and get in your car again, please?
I swear, 3 days ago, neither one of us would have ever pulled a stunt like this, but if you was able to meet my husband, you'd understand why.
What?
Boys, shoot the radio. Hit on. The police radio, Louise. Got it.
Thelma and Louise.
How do you like the vacation so far? We'll be drinking margaritas by the sea, Mamacita.
It really is an incredible film, and I was actually asked to go and see this when it came out by my tutor, because I was reading English at university in Leeds, and gender and popular culture was an option I jumped at. And we'd analyse adverts, we'd analyse all sorts of things from a feminist perspective, and films was one of them. And I went to see Thelma and Louise and was just completely blown away by this, again, a very accessible film, very entertaining. You know, the boyfriend I was with at the time loved it just as much as me. Everyone was roaring with laughter and crying in the cinema. It was a uniting film, but it told a story that isn't told enough. And it wasn't kind of a woe is me feminist tale. It told it how it is, you know, the way that some women are treated and worse. So with a massive sense of entertainment, I think. That probably, looking back, started to sow some of the seeds of Girls on Film when I saw that.
Yeah. And did you then sort of, having done this module in university and having seen this, then start to look at films sort of with a different perspective? Like where, and as you said, you know, where are the films for me that reflect me back at me?
Definitely. I mean, I think I was already identifying as a feminist of sorts before that. And I was going to lectures and things about, you know, sexism in language and, you know, why are we always saying chairman rather than chairwoman? So I was quite engaged with that sort of thing already. But I think it enhanced it definitely. And it made me think much more about representation in film and much more about things that weren't really being talked about outside of academia then.
Yes.
You know, yeah, basically, you know, the depiction of women in films and the gender dynamic and all that sort of thing.
Did you find this period of sort of reviewing quite frustrating then, the films that you were seeing week on week that you were having to do for the magazines that you were working for?
Yes, I think I was. And it was interesting that when I started writing for mainstream titles, a lot of the time I was given the chick flicks and the rom-coms and the kids films, and that's fine. And it was interesting in the late 90s to be writing about those films. It was a mixed time, but there were a lot of them. And I, you know, I got to sort of compare every Jennifer Aniston film against each one for feminist points or lack of. I've always said I've never complained about my job, and I always find it really interesting to analyse films that don't match up to my personal standards of diversity or whatever. And I can still very much enjoy them, I think, often. Yeah, it wasn't frustrating, but it was interesting. And I felt energised to champion the films that did get it right and did offer something for the little girls who want to watch themselves travel through time, like Marty yes. McFly.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. So tell me about Thelma and Louise and sort of a favourite sort of scene in that. Are you sort of a fan of the ending, which was slightly changed from the original? They originally sort of, you saw them crash further down in the car, but they decided to change it to this sort of moment where they're frozen in time, completely free. Are you a fan of that one? Is there another scene that particularly you think gets the sort of female experience?
I think the ending has to be that way, and I'm very pleased that it is that way. I think it would have been awful downer, literally, if we'd have seen that it happen otherwise. Some of my favourite scenes are, again, the comedy scenes. I mean, of course, I could say Brad Pitt's entrance. You know, obviously, that's etched into my mind forever, as anyone who saw it. But I think I actually really love the dynamic between Thelma and her husband, Daryl, played by Christopher McDonald, who's so completely useless. And there's a brilliant moment where the police are saying to him, you know, they're bugging the phone. Look, if she phones up, just act normal, because he's always normally quite vile to her. And of course, he picks up the phone and goes, "Hello, Velma," in this kind of very cheerful sort of way. And then she immediately put the phones down. That, to me, sums up the relationship between them, is that she's always been smarter than him. He's completely stupid. His stupidity is assisting their escape, which gives the viewer a great satisfaction. So there's lots of things going on that scene that I think help propel the plot forward, give the women an extra chance, and also demonstrate how much smarter they are.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of smart women, you started the Girls on Film podcast because you wanted to have a platform to talk about films that represented the female experience and to really, champion those. Why did you think that was so needed when you set it up?
Well, it was originally an idea for a TV show that I had. And I was noticing, as you've noticed, Jane, that often as, female pundits, we're asked to go on TV not talking to other women, but talking to men. But whereas the industry standard would be to have two men. Two women talking about something would be considered far too niche and no one would want to see it. That was the message I was getting. But also lots of other reasons. It felt like the time that I set it up with Heather Archbold, who was my agent and still is my agent at the time and also a producer. Time's Up had just happened. More conversations were happening about women in Hollywood. Finally, it felt like that there was a room for those discussions outside of what people perceive to be a niche. But we felt by actually doing a very accessible film show that's kind of fun and that men want to listen to as well, we were proving that it isn't niche, that it's just, this is part of the whole type of conversation we should be having about film. And often we do feature women and we don't necessarily focus on the feminist aspect. We just want to highlight their work and shine a light on them when perhaps they might be, for reasons including unconscious bias, excluded from the conversation in more mainstream outlets.
Yes. And it's apt that you are our first female journalist on this podcast. We haven't had a female journalist yet. So you are our first, blazing a trail. Tell us more about Girls on Film. What's your favourite thing about it? And who have been your favourite guests?
I love it when the women that come on are extremely honest and open about what's been going on in their lives. And that happens almost all the time. We tend to interview people outside of a junket format. So they're very willing and relaxed. And they also are very connected with the subject. I mean, one of our first celebrity interviews in episode 3 was Carey Mulligan, and she was so keen to talk about feminism and the conditions on set and things that she doesn't normally get asked about. Sarah Soleimani, more recently last year, we had on talking about some very traumatic things that had happened to her on film sets. And I was really shocked to hear that, but we had a really productive conversation when I could feel her really opening up. But then we've had people like Linda Hamilton talking about the Terminator series and action women. And again, what I like is that nearly always these women say, "Oh, this is great because no one else is asking us this question." I mean, that might not even be the case now, not nobody else, but most other people aren't asking them the questions. So you get some really fun and interesting stuff from people when it's got a slightly different angle.
Mm. And in the time it's been going, have you seen a change in the industry, do you think?
Definitely. It's really positive. I think we've seen so many more people coming to the podcast and, asking us to do shows in Cannes, in Rotterdam and Edinburgh. We do a lot of live shows and they're increasingly popular. We're at Latitude Festival. So the kind of appetite that you see from people for that kind of conversation has increased. But also when we have actors on and directors on and film critics on, I think they're mostly agreed that things are moving on. And even though there's lots of room for improvement, people are saying, "Oh, finally," they actually want to hire a female director. Like when Rose Glass came on talking about St. Maud, she was saying, "Well, actually, finally, eventually, by the time I was making it, people were actively looking to hire women and to give women the funding." Obviously, that's not always the case, but gradually in more educated circles, I think that is happening. But people have almost been shamed. The money people yes. would be shamed into going, "We have to do something about it. We have to hire more women. We have to hire more people of colour. This is just not good enough."
Yeah, indeed. Let's move on then to your next film, which is about a woman and centres on a woman. Very different from the last two films. What is your third film?
The Last Seduction.
Different than the others, Mike. I feel like maybe I could love you.
But the last seduction.
What type of list are we trying to make?
Cheating husband list.
Was murder.
This guy in New York. 10 million payoff to the widow if he dies of an unnatural death. She's willing to give us a third.
You're talking about murder.
You, me,
$3 million. The only loser in the whole deal is a wife-beating old bastard.
You're crazy.
I'm out of here, Mike. You have a way of making a woman feel like a one-way train ticket.
I'll do it. I'll kill the bastard.
You're up for this, right?
If you find her, I'd be glad to separate her from the cash.
She's here. She's in New York.
Let's go for a little drive.
Where does this end with you?
What the hell are you doing?
Saucy, clever, smart. My God, I was blown away when I first saw this film. You know, it was, again, the 90s, and I was finding my feet in terms of feminism and frustrated with the lack of, frankly, brilliant female villains in film. And here you have a villain who is at the center of the story. She is a potentially murderous con artist who uses her sexuality and her incredible brain to get what she wants when she's outsmarted her husband and moves to the sticks and shacks up with some unsuspecting dude. And the story is really well crafted. It's really well written. She became a bit of an icon. And I think, I mean, in feminist terms, it is problematic. But the fact was, is that we were, men and women, starved of this kind of heroine at that point. Yes, it was a film noir, but when I interviewed the writer, Steve Ferrantic, he said that, you know, I'm going to quote him here. He said, "I wrote her to be the protagonist, not the femme fatale seen through the sex-struck, lovesick sap's eyes. I realised halfway through the drafting process that it was a lot more interesting being privy to her machinations than blind to them." And I think that's really part of the key of this film, is that you with her, you're not watching her through the male gaze, even though it is a male director and a male writer. You know, women and men find this film very sexy as well as fun. And there may be a trans issue, which we could go into as a slight spoiler. But generally, I think this is a really, really smart film. And I was privileged to write a big piece on this for the BBC, which is when I found the writer. Unbelievably, I found him on Facebook and friended him. We're now friends on Facebook. I'm just like chatting about this, you know, I'm just nerding out about The Last Seduction. It is one I like to pick for this purpose, because still some people haven't seen it, particularly younger people. And you are in for a treat. If you like a dark crime comedy, then, and Bill Pullman as well is tremendous in this, then definitely join us for this screening, please.
It obviously brings up, as you said, the sort of sexuality of women there. Is that something that you think is changing as well? I mean, and Thelma and Louise touches on this as well, that, you know, Thelma isn't allowed to enjoy her sexuality and her wants and her needs and her passion. She finds that with JD. And in this one as well, this woman is unapologetic about being sexual. Do you think we're seeing a change there in film as well?
Gradually. This is weirdly almost one of the last things to go, the idea of the sex scene of the man thrusting away and the woman sort of writhing obligingly underneath, or various sort of women on top, Verhoeven twists on that. It's very interesting. And I think that's why we have launched, when we did our Girls on Film Awards earlier this year in 2022, we decided to have the Best Female Orgasm Award. And it wasn't a sort of tittering, jokey thing, although, of course, it is quite amusing. The idea is that we so rarely see women genuinely enjoying sex on screen in a way that isn't purely designed for male titillation, in a way that seems authentic, that perhaps young women and boys watching could learn from positively, rather than these kind of semi-90s erotica that very much from the male gaze, and which I think probably quite unhelpful when it comes to building healthy sex lives. So I think it is changing with, you know, I think TV's ahead, as is often the way. People like Lena Dunham are doing interesting things on that, Fleabag. And then in film, I think the next director we're going to mention is doing good things as well. There are many great women and some men working to improve this, but it's slow progress.
Tell us who won the Best Orgasm on your awards.
So this was the film I'm Your Man, starring Maren Egert and Dan Stevens as a robot who is a love bot, or an attempted love bot for an intellectual who doesn't really want anything to do with it. And of course, spoiler alert, they end up having robot sex, whatever you want to call it. But the build up to that is very much about the emotions behind her own sexuality. So this character's sexuality, and it's really exploring how we form our sexual preferences and our romantic preferences, and how the psychology of our love lives. And I think every moment in the film was kind of building up to that orgasm scene, and the expressions that flicker across her face, and it is all on her, really say so much about the film and also a lot about the issues that it was exploring. So it was really interesting.
Mm. So let's move on. You mentioned the next director. What is your final film in this female lineup of gorgeousness that you're putting on?
Olivia Wilde's Booksmart.
Nobody knows that we are fun. We didn't party because we wanted to focus on school and get into good colleges.
And it worked.
But the irresponsible people who partied also got into those colleges. We have to go to a party tonight.
What?
No.
No?
No.
Not acceptable.
This is not okay.
Who allowed you to be this beautiful?
Who allowed you to be this beautiful?
Who allowed you to take my breath away?
Picture this. I'm a bag of...
Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Dever, couple of studious girls who go partying at the end of college. And I just think this is just an adorable film from start to finish. I mean, I would go back to Back to the Future and say, in terms of films that don't waste any scenes, you know, this is, every scene is right. I can't think of a dud scene in this film. It's funny, it's charming, it's clever, but it wears its intelligence very lightly. You can giggle along to it with friends. And its politics are a big thumbs up from me. You know, you've got... I related to it because I had a friend that came out to me when I was younger. And so this is the story of, you know, a straight girl and her gay friend and the kind of conversations they're having about their respective love lives at an age where your hormones are raging, but you don't really know what to do with them. So I thought that was really beautifully done and really sensitively done and very funny. Again, this one goes down a storm in the cinema with a large group. So I would absolutely encourage everyone to enjoy this one together.
Yeah, and it's got a banging soundtrack, and it's sort of one of those things that I sort of found with Eighth Grade quite similarly. And I know you had Bo Burnham on your show, like one of your few male directors that you've had on your show, because it really does advocate kindness and empathy and understanding, and that even the mean kids who appear to be mean at the beginning aren't mean. They just need to be understood, and they're actually really quite nice and kind. And it such a relief, isn't it, to watch a film where everyone's just a nice kid, really, and they're all just muddling through it. They're messy, they're trying to get through life, but nobody's an absolute asshole, and that's just really lovely to watch.
I agree, and it explores that grey area, because even our heroines are quite often mistaken about people. They think they know best, but actually then they soften, and even though they are lovely people, this is very forgiving, as you say, in terms of people making mistakes in their judgment, which you of course do a lot in life, especially when you're young. I interviewed the two stars in episode 14 of Girls on Film, and of course, as you know, they are just delightful, which is such a relief. They are as lovely as that, and they are as cute and kind of in platonic love with each other as they are on screen, which is absolutely adorable.
Yeah, because they actually, didn't they, before filming, they actually moved in together, and throughout the filming, they were living in an apartment together. So they just totally made that friendship feel completely organic by actually living it. Booksmart, as you say, brings up these ideas that we do make mistakes and we, you know, there's things we would have done differently. Would you have done anything differently in your career so far, knowing what you know now?
God, loads of things. I'm always unfortunately one of those people that's constantly going back and re-editing the past, probably why I love time travel movies. I might have spent less time in dance music magazines, which is where I initially cut my teeth, even though it was fun and messy and crazy. And would I have done anything differently? Although, no, to be honest, though, I'm happy to say I'm proud of where I am now, and that I am going on national and international TV talking about film in a time when still we need more women to do that. And I've been president of the Critics Circle, so I'm pretty happy with that. And Girls on Film, I'm really proud of. I just want Girls on Film to get bigger and better and to end up on TV, to be honest. Yeah, you know what? I'm not going to go into the minutiae. Generally, I'm just going to say, I just got to keep on learning, just like the girls in Booksmart, because like, that's a big thing for me on Girls on Film, is that I'm always learning from our guests. I'm hopefully never the one going, I'm the most PC one here and I know what's what, you know, is getting people on who can teach me a thing or two and help me to actually uncover some of my biases that I haven't thought of yet.
Mm. Yes. And, you know, a question that is always asked of film journalists, what's your most memorable interview or set visit that you've been on? And is there one that went pear-shaped?
The pear-shaped ones, I don't know if we're allowed to name names, but it's interesting. There's a few that every time I've spoken to another journalist, they've gone, oh, yeah, they're pretty notorious. I did one once with Dev Patel and Tom Wilkinson paired for Metro for Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. And Dev was gorgeous and lovely. And Tom Wilkinson was just in a terrible mood. And I think he just hates interviews. And when I've seen Dev since, he said, oh God, that went down in history, because I just didn't let Tom Wilkinson get away with it. I was just in that mood that I was like, I'm not going to let you be rude to me. So I was like, well, why don't you like interviews? What's your problem? So it actually ended up being quite an interesting piece in Metro. But Dev was just sat there going, oh God, in the middle.
Stop fighting,
really
mum
nice.
And dad.
I wasn't that rude, but it was just like, I just felt like he was being quite rude to me. So yeah, so that was an interesting one. But mostly people have been absolutely adorable. I always think Julianne Moore is amazing to talk to, Jessica Chastain, Sigourney Weaver. I've been lucky enough to speak to some of the finest, and mostly they're just amazing.
And have you managed to speak to somebody that as a kid watching those films next to you always wanted to meet, and you've actually got that opportunity? Has that happened yet, or is there somebody still on the bucket list?
Well, I haven't done Michael J. Fox yet, so
there you go.
I've done quite a few Back to the Future people, only on the phone slightly. So Leah Thompson I did, and I did the doc, and that was amazing. I was freaking out. But I mean, I don't normally get at all starstruck, but there's that moment, as you say. I was even freaking out when I friended the guy from The Last Seduction, the writer on Facebook. That's my kind of excitement, you know. But Tom Cruise, whatever, you know.
He speaks very highly of you.
I just meant that's the kind of person a lot of people would get overexcited about meeting. And yes. I'm just like, he's
You're more
great,
into filmmakers.
But there's certain people that I just I'm geeky about. That's all.
Yes, absolutely. I understand. I am the same. Okay, so that's your programme. But we need to know, what are you eating? Are you a salty or a sweet popcorn fan, or are you no popcorn?
Well, in the States, growing up, we had the salty popcorn. So I'm going to go for salty popcorn. Although I will take sweet if it's given to me. But there's always too much, in my view. A very small box will do me fine, thank you. Generally, I'm not a big fan of eating in the cinema for purist reasons.
Yes.
The agreed. Noise.
Yes. Yeah. My heart sinks when I see a box of nachos come in with all the sauce and everything else. And are you a fan of trailers or no trailers? Do you like to just get straight in and the lights go down, off you go? Or are you a fan of watching those trailers?
I'm not a fan of adverts, but I think if the trailers are upcoming stuff that I'm keen to see, yes. But obviously as a film critic, if you're going to the regular cinema, 9 times out of 10, you've seen the films that they're trailing. So in that case, we'd try to time it to go straight in, avoid the trailers.
Yeah. And we must say that as film critics, we are in the very luxurious position that we go to a film, the lights go down and it starts. We don't have any sort of faffing about with any other preamble. We just get straight to the business of the film. So we are quite lucky in that respect. Right. As the screen burns on this last night, what movie soundtrack are you going to be playing out to?
Well, when we have live episodes of Girls on Film, we actually warm the audience up as they're waiting with some fun little tunes from the movies. And some of those come from the film 9 to 5. Mm. So I'm going to have a bit of Dolly Parton singing As Everyone Leaves, because it puts a spring in your step, doesn't it? And it reminds you of another film that I could have easily picked for this lineup, because it is just an absolute corker. So yeah, going to have Dolly in 9 to 5.
Yeah, that is a great film. And that is a great feminist film as well, which is quite ahead of its time when that came out.
Definitely, definitely. If by chance someone hasn't seen it, see it, you will not be disappointed.
Absolutely. Okay, so Anna's last picture show programme will be Back to the Future, Thelma and Louise, The Last Seduction and Booksmart. Thank you so much for joining us, Anna. That is a great lineup. I'm totally there for that. When are you putting it on? I'll get my diary out. I'll be there.
Well, if it's my last day on earth, hopefully many, many, many years to come, Jane, but I'll let you know. And I'd love to
just
see
WhatsApp
you there in
me.
Our Zimmer frames.
Yeah.
WhatsApp won't exist then. I'll send you a psychic message, right? And
yes.
You just get it.
Yes. Well, you'll have to send it to my nurse, because I will be very, very old by then. And, you know, living with a lot of care, and we'll get down to that cinema and watch those. And I think they'll probably still stand the test of time, because they are absolute crackers. Okay.
I'm glad cool. You enjoyed them.
I did. And we'll be back with another Last Picture Show. So do come back to see who's in the projector booth next time. Thanks for joining us. Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. 9 to 5. For service and devotion. You would think that I would deserve a fair promotion.
should want to move ahead, but the boss won't seem to let me. I swear sometimes that man is out to get me.
That was the Last Picture Show podcast from Total Film. Let us know what four films you'd watch at the end of the world. You can tweet us on @TotalFilm or connect with us on Facebook or our Instagram page.